It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Glad to be here, Mike.
And on the phone, Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hey, Mike and Terry. Good to be here.
So where is here for you? Are you in deep snow or what?
In the deep snow off Palmer Fishhook.
Okay, that's good. Well, you have had an article that I read this morning in the Anchorage Daily News about how water from wells can be of different colors. And you have some personal experience with this. I was fascinated by the range of issues that people now are discovering with their wells, but more significantly, what could be done as an individual to go from odd-colored water to clear water. Do you want to summarize a little bit of that?
Sure, and I think one of the issues that some people are still looking at after the earthquake 2 weeks ago, today, it's Friday morning, is the fact that some of our water still hasn't settled down yet. And I wrote a story for the paper about the impact that the earthquake is having on private water wells. It also had an impact on community water systems, so that's a non-public supply that serves 25 people or more. There's some other conditions. But it felt like the private well angle was more important because you're sort of on your own. You kind of have to figure out what to do from scratch, depending on your level of expertise. And I personally am still dealing with water issues with my well outside Palmer. And so, there's a tremendous range that people are dealing with. And some people did start dealing with issues like at least, turbid or silty water until sometime after the earthquake. Mm. When they went through their holding tank of clear water and then hit the earthquake water. And so other people are dealing with water that tests positive for total coliform bacteria. Mm. My well is in that group. Mm. And then dealing with the kind of the shocking with bleach, flushing with water. I think we're all learning way too much about our wells. And part of it, there's not a case. It's a case-by-case situation because, drinking water wells, if it's a private well, are at different depths, in different geology, and may have had different impact from shaking. And to be clear, my story and myself, it was not an expert opinion. I think it's probably unlikely that most people have, our well casings broken somehow by the earthquake. But I have heard a number of stories of, people whose pumps stopped working, water pipes broke underground. Mm. And then there's this general report of just cloudy or silty water still, which my water also falls into that category. And so that, given the aftershocks, isn't shocking, but given 2 weeks past, I know personally, if mine doesn't clear up by early next week, I'm going to call a well contractor. Mm. I'm also waiting for my second round of bacteria test results to come back in today. So next week, I can let you all know.
So it seems like that is the way to go. If you begin to notice something odd, that contacting DEC, having your well water tested, and then going to a well contractor is really what the private individual next steps are.
Well, I think that's right.
But you could have bacteria in your water without having had this happen. So people should test them, now and again to make sure that doesn't happen.
And I did. When I talked with the testing lab in Mat-Su that's seeing a lot of personal or private water samples, mm-hmm. That was a point that their lab analyst made, was mm-hmm. that most of us don't get our well water tested regularly. And so it's possible that they're seeing this spike, which they are, in people who are testing positive for total coliform because it's been there all along. We just didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. Total coliform doesn't necessarily make you sick.
Yeah,
it's an indicator that there may be a pathway for other pathogens to get into your water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know there's a fair amount of wells, too, up in the Willow area with arsenic. And I see how that's shaken out, too. I mean, you have to have a lot of arsenic before it really is a problem. It's a smelling problem. It's a lot of other things, but you have to have a big concentration of it. But, yeah, again, the schools, I think, have been pretty have been very diligent in testing all of them, but they're still waiting for some results, too.
And I had the opportunity to speak with the city manager of Palmer, and he went over what happens with the city's water system. The city uses wells also, but they are deep wells. And the first thing they do as they walk through the protocol after an event like this is to make sure that the wells are functioning correctly. And they do tests many days during a week, 2 to 5 times a week. And they're under the guidance of the EPA to ensure that they do this because they're a public system. So in one sense, we've handed off, as we live in the city, to the city the responsibility for testing. And they are, it seems, doing due diligence. It's just the idea, I think, that we've heard about Flint, Michigan. We've heard about some other places where there's been a failure in the system to properly test water.
So if people have to build a new well, is there FEMA dollars available for that, do you think, Zaz, or is there any avenues for that?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that especially if and I do think that'll be really unusual, but yes, I think if you have to drill a new well, then you can at least get compensated for part of that cost sometime in the future. But if I remember right, I mean, it's, what, $1,000 a foot? The wells are, maybe it's $100. It's expensive to drill a new well. I think it's $1,000. And so it just gets to the point where, you know, it's going to be out of pocket until you get compensated, if you get compensated.
Okay. The other issue following on after the earthquake has to do with building structures. Again, from the city manager, as he reviewed what was happening here in the city of Palmer, there's very little structural damage as contrasted with both the borough at large, or for that matter, Anchorage, where there appear to be perhaps as many as 100 buildings that have such significant damage that they will be removed from their place. Is that consistent with what you're understanding, Saz?
Yeah, in terms of devastation, in terms of collapse or buildings that are total loss, I think there was just one, I thought maybe two, but one, and that was destroyed by fire here in Mat-Su, but then, you know, another hundred, several hundred more reports of levels of damage ranging from relatively minor to major.
Sure. Okay. Well, since we've been talking with you and we've mentioned the paper, the Anchorage Daily News, I think a number of people were pleasantly surprised, in one sense, by the Anchorage Daily News being selected to be in a partnership. I think there were 14 newspapers around the country with an investigative group. Would you talk a little bit about that, what you know about it, and what you foresee that doing for the paper?
Yeah, that's a partnership with ProPublica that the Daily News applied for and was happy to find that we got, along with a little more than a dozen other news outlets around the country. ProPublica is a nonprofit, kind of a fact-finding organization that really lends a lot of kind of straightforward investigative muscle to newsrooms. You know, and I know from personal experience, our newsroom is kind of lean and mean right now. We have, you know, a lot of ability, but not a ton of time. And so having this kind of help from outside in terms of resources is incredibly beneficial right now. And the you know, the person who is sort of leading the project is Kyle Hopkins, but we will all be involved.
So does that mean that they will be investigating from afar, or they'll just supplement you to have more people on the ground?
No, they'll be supplementing our coverage.
Okay.
I believe we're focusing on the real problem of sex assault in Alaska throughout the state.
Okay.
Bravo.
Wonderful.
Yeah, one more story you were working on that got my attention, Zaz, was the spam that got caught at
Right.
Yeah.
And that's not the kind of spam that Alaskans are famous for eating, but it's a different sort.
Yeah, mail spam.
Yeah, an email was a national problem, although I only heard about it because there was something that came across the emergency scanner about the main emergency services headquarters just outside Wasilla at Station 6-5 was evacuated because of a bomb threat.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to confirm that, about an hour later, I realized that, gosh, this is happening all around the country. And at this point, it's pretty apparent that it was a scam, that it was not a credible threat, but there were people around the country evacuating buildings for a little while, and in Anchorage as well, and probably other parts of Alaska.
So is that one of those things where they pulled the FBI in and try to find where that came from?
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting. There's a pretty simple rule to know who you're opening attachments from, and I know it's not always easy because there's ways to make it look like people that you know, but it seems to be the same pathway every time on attachments.
Right. Okay. So we had a few other things here, shifting away from Zaz, your work. We actually had a series of meetings on Tuesday that were of interest. The city of Palmer completed its budget work. So I've observed this before. It was a hard, you do all kinds of work on the budget. It's anticipation, et cetera. And in this case, the city council unanimously approved the budget. And then there was this kind of deflated feeling of anticlimactic, okay, it's done. But the real, I think, important observation is that the budget for the city of Palmer is balanced. It doesn't hold anything surprising or new in it. It's in many ways a continuation of budgets past. But it's done, and the advantage is that the city begins its annual year on the 1st of January and moves forward. And I think there is no the big news, if you will, for Palmer is that there are a number of entities that are moving. These are businesses that are moving out here that are bringing with them a series of jobs. Hmm. We're talking 50, 60, or 70 jobs, which in a community of this size is big. We've talked about one of these that involves the land area by the fairgrounds where there is demolition materials that are placed. And that entity that runs that is actually moving its headquarters out here, as well as another processing building kind of facility that's going into what was the old ATCO building and is reported to have roughly 60 jobs or so associated with it. So that was the city of Palmer's news. Over at the borough building, we had a joint meeting that involved both the school board and the assembly. Terry, do you want to just maybe highlight a few things that came out of that?
Yeah, the really big thing was the resolution that came back to the assembly. They had a little bit of their own business on the agenda, which they took up first, having to do with trash from the earthquake. And it was a resolution that came before them a couple of weeks ago at their emergency meeting, I guess. There wasn't enough assembly members to make it work. Mr. Beck was out of town, wasn't available, and it went down with two people objecting, but it came back. It came back this time. Not only Mr. Mayfield, who's been diligent in bringing this forth, giving the people of the borough the same ability that the people of Anchorage did to get rid of their damaged goods from the earthquake, the result of the earthquake, for a short period of time. And he was joined on the resolution with not only Ms. Bovey from the Talkeetna area that sponsored last time, but also Mr. Ted Leonard from Wasilla was also a sponsor of it. So a discussion took place. Same didn't change anything. Mr. Sumner, who was against the ordinance, brought couple of amendments he tried to go through, one having to do with just allowing people that had actually filed damages with the borough to be able to dump, and another one saying that we should just set up a benevolent fund, which kind of reminded me of past years when Mr. DeVilbiss was mayor, wanted a benevolent fund that I don't think ever grew to anything. But that was the way he wanted to take care of it. He didn't think that we should be giving anything away at the landfill. And Mr. McKee, of course, as he did last time, joined him in that sentiment. But at the end of the day, it was a 5-2 vote, and the dump or the landfill is open for anybody. It's very narrow in that you can't just take your everyday garbage there. It's supposed to actually be from the result of the earthquake. In fact, Mr. Leonard asked for a report after what that actually cost the landfill. I'm not sure how they're going to figure that out, but they'll figure it out in a future meeting. So that was a significant piece. And the rest of it mostly was having to do with the school board reporting on how they had handled the earthquake. Of course, everybody looked pretty tired, but also very grateful that all the kids had gotten out and employees. And that is, it's a process to get everything back up and operational, but they're almost there. They've got a couple of schools that were damaged pretty bad, Colony Middle School, I believe, and Houston Middle School, those were built back in the 80s. Both of those schools are going to take extensive repair, so they're going to be doubling up for a while. They're moving some portables out there to Houston High, which is right next door to Houston Middle School, and they're going to be working with the high school to accommodate the kiddos out there, and then Colony Middle will just be starting a little late. The borough's running those projects, the capital department. And the other big piece of news, I guess, in that, Mike, is that we're lucky in that the school district was included in the insurance that was covering earthquakes up to $25 million in damage. They pay 80% of that premium, and the borough pays 20%, which to cover their roads, and they don't have very many of their own buildings, although they own all the school buildings, but the bulk of the premium for that, the school district pays. So we'll see how far that money goes. They pointed out that Anchorage, as far as they were knew, didn't have any earthquake insurance, so they feel to be a little ahead of the game to have that much, although it's probably not going to come close to fixing all the repairs. Maybe they're going to be leaning on, of course, the state to see if they can give some hand, and also FEMA funds to see what else can be. So all the verdict is out on what the total cost is going to be and where all the money is going to come, but they felt good about that part of it. So those are probably the most significant things of that particular meeting. A couple of other things.
And meanwhile, the new governor, Dunleavy, has traveled to Washington, D.C. and sat with other new governors to meet with President Trump. And in the process in between traveling there and that meeting, he has been selecting additional members to fill out his cabinet. The news from the legislature remains in some ways the most interesting. We've had a representative from Kenai, Mr. Knapp, who has said, okay, I'm not going to join the Republican assumed majority of 21. And we still have, continue on as best I know, the suit and countersuit regarding the results for the one district up in the Fairbanks area, formerly held by Scott Kawasaki. That's a one vote this way, that way type of situation. So all of this leaves, I think, a most unusual situation. I do not believe I have in memory any time when the legislature is going to likely go to January, and it may be the last week before they actually meet down there, that they have some idea of who will be in the position of being able to place the chairman of various committees, et cetera. Zaz, do you have any other information about that? Have you caught it?
I don't. I haven't been tracking that one so closely.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that they definitely, it's a new thing, but they'll get it worked out one way or the other. I think the court cases will be settled prior to that, we're talking the end of January. Now, whether we'll actually have a coalition or we'll have a couple of coalitions, which has happened before, the Senate's pretty settled down. In fact, they've already made appointments to committees and increased the size of the Finance Committee. But it's the House, really, that's in flux. And they will wait till those court cases come up. And, you know, who knows? It is going to be – it's always interesting at the beginning of a two-year the first year of a two-year session, particularly when there's a new governor in town, a lot of new staff for his office. He's let go a fair amount of people from the Walker administration. And so that's going to be new. There's going to be a lot of people down there just trying to look at the lay of the land and protecting what they have and trying to get new programs put in. So it's going to be a very interesting first year for sure, and probably second year too of this session.
And I think reality is finally coming face to face with the governor and his staff. The note that I saw regarding what budget will be presented, which by law must be presented by the new incoming governor, is that he's going to take pretty much Governor Walker's proposed budget, tweak it a little bit, present it, and then has said that come January they would do the modifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's always, it seemed to me to be a kind of strange way of doing business. I'd almost think for those years where you have a continuation of a person in that seat as governor, works okay. But and I'm just wondering, what does it is the legislative not body not in session very often with new people? What are they going to do with this budget before January? Maybe there's a process that I'm unaware of, but I think it really means then the incoming governor has to say, well, unless he's really or she has a lot of work done, this is a very difficult thing to change a massive budget of this.
Well, he gets another whack at it, too, because they present their budget and then, of course, the legislature works on it. They bring all the departments in and do all of that sort of horse and pony show. And then the governor does get another chance before they vote on it to do a supplement budget and change some deck chairs around, too. So it's a long process, and it doesn't have to be done. It has, you know, they have 120 days. They like to get out of there in 90 days. That hasn't happened for quite some time now. It sounds like there's some intent to do that, but they are going to have to work fast.
Especially if it's going to involve the permanent fund, mm-hmm, and monies derived from the fund to support government. People will be watching carefully to see if the promises made during campaign can be kept.
Right.
Well, folks, I think we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. I just want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling from her house there out in the world of bad wells. Thank you, Zaz.
from the Palmer Fishhook Bureau.
Yes.
Anytime.
And thank you, Terry Snyder,
for
coming.
Yeah, keep us updated on that. Good luck with that, Zaz.
Okay.
Thanks.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.